Chapter 14. In the Kingdom of the Blind. The spiritual journey does not consist of arriving at a new destination where a person gains what he did not have or becomes what he is not. It consists in the dissipation of one's own ignorance concerning oneself and life, and the gradual growth of that understanding which begins the spiritual awakening. Aldous Huxley. In the kingdom of the blind, the one-eyed man is a boob. He is a butterfly among caterpillars, a vampire among humans, a one-eyed fool in a land of no-eyed wise men. He is not superior, not powerful, just out of place, a stranger in a strange land. Why does he linger? What should he do? Speak? Teach? Play wise? What can the one-eyed say to the blind since birth? Why say anything? What does he want for them or from them? The blind know nothing of eyes. They know nothing of sight. And those who think they know wrong. Why speak at all? Why should the sighted add his voice to the din of unsighted who claim to see, and who, unfettered by truth, are free to tell a better tale? Why undertake so futile and thankless a mission? The sighted might start out with an attitude of patience toward the skepticism of the unsighted, remembering that he himself was once in such a blind and doubly blind condition. But tolerance soon wears thin. Indulging ego's need to feel intelligent and discriminating is wearisome and only serves to unmask the folly of altruistic motives. Or so I can imagine. I am not motivated by altruism or results. So seeing Maya maintain her stranglehold on blacked-out humanity doesn't rub me wrong. I work for the universe, for the books, so whatever serves them serves me. Okay, then, says Lisa a few minutes later, settling into the lounger next to mine with her notepad and pen. So why do you think it happened? What was the point of crashing your motorcycle? You said that you knew in the first instant that it wouldn't be bad. Was that the point, then? I shake my head to clear it. Doesn't work. Whenever I wonder why something happened, I tell her, I think first about the books. Does it somehow serve the books? In this case, spilling the bike and getting a little busted up, the answer is definitely yes.
It is?
It is. And you showed me that.
I did?
You offered to help me with the book. So I handed you the rough draft of a chapter about how the integrated state actually works, which is what I've been working on for the last few days. You weren't satisfied with what I had written so far. So you asked for an example. And there it was, ripped from today's headlines. The accident was the perfect way of saying what I was trying to say in that rough draft. I hadn't even really thought about it until you asked for an example. See how this kind of builds on itself? She shakes her head no. I shake my own head again. I'm only putting this together as I say it, so I need my brain to stop pulsing, humming. It doesn't stop. Not only does the accident serve the book, I say, but the way the accident serves the book serves the book. She looks even more puzzled. I circle back. When you read those pages, I say, what did you think?
It was good, she says. A little dry. I could tell it was a draft.
Right. It was a work in progress. That's how I figure out what I want to say, and if it's worth saying. The writing itself is my part in the process.
I do my part, and the universe does its part. Okay? Okay, she says. So I gave you those pages, and you asked for an example, which brought the bike accident to mind and made me realize that it was actually a much more suitable way of expressing this knowledge. Everything I was trying to say in that rough draft was summed up right there in that first instant of the accident. Then why did you think the accident happened before that? I'm not a kid anymore and shouldn't be riding a busted-up old Triumph across Mexico. That came through loud and clear. I was going to take the bike to Puerto Vallarta next week, but I think those days are behind me. Thank God, she says, though I'm not sure that Pinto's much better. So you thought the accident was just a warning for you to stop riding old motorcycles in Mexico? I really hadn't processed it yet. I just got back here and sat down a few minutes before you showed up, I answer. Anyway, you came and asked about helping, and here we are. So in a way, she says, the motorcycle accident was like a happy coincidence. Yes, and in that same way, my life is just one long string of happy coincidences. A coincidence is an unplanned alignment of events. Things happening in a way that seems planned, even though it's just an accident. In my case, I don't see the accident part, just the planned part, the alignment, the coherence, not just now and then, but all the time, more certain than sunrise. So yes, it's a happy coincidence from the eyes-closed perspective, but from the eyes-open perspective, this alignment is everywhere, all the time. It's like I live suspended in a network of invisible lines, and even though I can't see them, I know they're there, and I've learned how I fit in with them. They're always there, and should the day come when they're not, I'm content to fall. We sit quietly for a while. She writes, I slip into a funky haze. The afternoon eases into early evening. Lisa works on her notes and asks questions. I hover in a buzzy, semi-awake state, happy to watch the pool and the distant views, and to pet Maya, and to rise and fall on this wave of slow-motion thumping that starts in my head and radiates outward. Now and then, Lisa asks a question that initiates a fresh dialogue, followed by a pause as she takes more notes. Is this how it always works? She asks. The writing? I mean, the way you worked on that chapter you showed me? Pretty much, I say. I work on writing something for a while, and I almost get it right, but not quite. But that's about as far as I can take it. Then something happens. The exact right thing at the exact right time. And the scales fall away, and the whole thing just resolves into clarity. The last thread of the fabric is woven miraculously into place, and only then do you see the whole tapestry as a single, unified whole, and you grok in fullness. That was always my experience with spiritual autolysis, too. A lot of work goes into building this huge pile of brush. But not until that final, mysterious little spark comes from some unexpected direction and sets the whole thing ablaze, have you really mastered it? In spiritual autolysis, that blaze reduces an entire mountain of ignorance to ash. In the book, it purifies and brings things into focus, and you're left with some good material. And that's what happened here. That's what is happening here. I did my bit, wrote those pages, worked on it to understand what I was trying to say and why, and that's as far as I got. Then you played your role and showed me what I hadn't seen for myself, that the bike accident provided the perfect way of saying what I was trying to say. The piece slipped perfectly into place, and the puzzle was solved. Using your notes, I'll start over, and in a few hours I'll have the finished work as it was meant to be. Okay, she says. I can see all that, but how is it still happening? Because the story isn't just that the accident and our discussions will replace that chapter. The way in which this whole process has unfolded reveals a larger dimension of the process, which in turn provides an important and necessary contribution to the book. You're losing me a little. The accident provides that? The accident captures and consolidates the themes I was trying to express in that chapter I gave you. I got that, she says, and I played a role in all this? You still are. You're doing your part. I'm doing my part. The universe is doing its part. And now the book will have what it needs, a clear and lively illustration of my experience of direct knowing and of what I mean when I talk about the co-creative process and the universe laying the books out for me. What was just pages of flat, lifeless explanation will now be dynamic and personal with a dangerous motorcycle accident, my injuries and your touching concern, my drug abuse, our dialogue, and of course, the star of the show, the process itself. The books always find their way like that, the exact right thing at the exact right time. Not just the books, of course, everything. But we're looking at the books now. But how do you learn your part? How do you know what to do and what not to do? How do you know how the whole thing works? I wonder about that for a moment. It's like balance, I suppose. If someone with an underdeveloped balance mechanism asked you how you can stand up and maintain your balance without falling over, you couldn't tell them. It's just something that's perfectly natural to you. It developed in your early years without your conscious effort or participation. It's so simple and obvious to you that you can't understand why someone would ask about it. But to that person with no balance mechanism, it seems impossibly complex, maybe even miraculous or magical. She taps the table with her pen in mild exasperation. And this is something you're used to, she asks dubiously. The way this whole thing is happening, with the accident and me and everything? This is how everything works in my world. This is my experience of the dream state. Not just once in a while, but all the time. This is how integrated functioning is, elegant and smooth and easy. No rough edges, no gaps or sharp corners. It's always like this. I do my part, and the universe does its part, and everything just flows into an effortless confluence. This is how the books always work. This is what it means for the universe to lay them out for me. This is that process being illustrated. I play a role in the creation of the books, but I don't think of myself as their author, just a participant in the larger process. Still, she says, you have to admit that many of mankind's greatest accomplishments would never have been possible without the drive and personal vision of men and women of very strong and forceful egoic constitutions, people who know what they want and get it without a lot of waiting and wishing and observing. We owe our civilization to them. Such as it is, if you still want to make that assertion in a few years, after you've had a good look around, I'd be grateful to be shown what you see and discuss it with you. For now, you can make note of the distinction between egoic demanding and the process of co-creative allowing. So now this is for me? Of course it's for you. From your perspective, the whole universe is for you. Who else? Do you have other examples? Lisa asks a bit later. Besides the motorcycle accident. I can give you endless examples, I say. It's like me asking you for examples of when you thought about something. A motorcycle accident is a big, flashy example. Buying the house is a great example. The way the first house I tried to buy was a setup, paving the way for the San Miguel house, is just gorgeous. Getting Maya is a great example, especially my part in the process. The patience and investigation and trust, the slow build, the effortless unfolding and perfect timing, the wonderful result. Writing the books is a great ongoing example of this co-creative process at work. Central to all these examples, and countless others I could provide, is the element of trust, of patience, of non-meddling. I have no ego making demands and insisting on ways and means, so events unfold in ways ego could never imagine or achieve. Those are all good examples, she remarks, jotting them down. But it's not these big blowout examples that I find most interesting. Those are secondary to the experience of the integrated state itself, the subtlety and elegance of it, the developing and refining of the senses, the entire state of living and being, of which whiz-bang examples are just a part. And one of the best parts of the whole thing, though it's lost to me now, is the mind-blowing personal renaissance of being out of the segregated state. I'm not sure I follow, she says. The best part of being out of a dungeon is being out of a dungeon. After that, the rest is just gravy. You'll know it for yourself soon enough, once you've settled a bit, and can look back from a bit more distance and grasp what you've really done. I look forward to getting some distance from it, she says tiredly, but I doubt I'll ever understand all this like you do. You can if you want, if you take an interest. I have a natural interest in the dream state and the workings of delusion and the creative process. How does this involve the creative process? She asks. That's what the whole thing really is. Life, I mean. A free-flowing, dynamic, creative process. Sometimes you hear creative-type people describing the way they step aside and allow the muse or inspiration to flow through them. Or the way Michelangelo described seeing the statue in the rock and then just chipping away everything that wasn't the statue. Seeing the rightness and removing the not rightness. It's like that, but in everything, not just artistic works. Your whole life becomes a creative process, a nuanced allowing, an imperceptible tendency toward rightness and away from not rightness, as refined and subtle as your mechanism of balance. She's quiet for a minute as she makes her notes. Aren't there books written about all this? She asks. I forget where we are. All what? Well, manifestation, I guess. Oh, yeah. There are a bunch of books, human and channeled, about manifestation of desires, the use of affirmation, wishcraft, laws of attraction, that sort of thing. The books I'm familiar with are all written for the segregated, ego-clad being, like how-to books for children. But children don't need books about how to act like adults. They need to become adults. The books promise ways of manifesting your desires, getting everything you want. But that's really the least of it. More like a pleasant side effect. In fact, I'm having a few pleasant side effects as I speak. I notice that I still have pain, but that it doesn't hurt. Curious, I have almost no experience with medication, but it seems very pleasant so far. As you're probably starting to see for yourself by now, I tell Lisa, being a rich, beautiful rock star in the segregated state is nothing. Getting to the integrated state is everything. No matter who you are or what you want, spiritually, creatively, or anything else, job one is always the same. Human adulthood. Nothing comes before that. There's no argument to be made in favor of human childhood except the arguments of fear and ego. I close one eye, and it's nice, so I close the other. Lisa says something. I open one eye, then the other. What? I ask. You said it's there for everyone, she says, that even in the ego-bound state we can still participate. But I don't really see that. Where is that happening? It takes me a minute to parse her question. Everywhere, I say. Everyone has some direct experience of what I'm talking about, where they sense that there's more to life than meets the eye, that there's something going on that they don't see. Maybe they have good instincts or intuition. Maybe they read their horoscopes in the paper, or play with tarot cards, or read tea leaves or chicken gizzards. A lot of people detect higher powers at work in their lives. They experience periods of flow where everything goes just right. They see coincidence and suspect it's more than that. They acknowledge some behind-the-scenes agency at work, and they call it synchronicity or serendipity or providence or God's hand. Lisa is writing down the examples as I come up with them. I'm kind of out of touch with the human experience, I continue, but I think most people see things they call miracles or divine intervention. Guardian angels helping out, prayers answered, deities or discarnate entities participating in their lives. They see events unfolding just so, auspiciously or fortuitously or whatever. The certain accident they miraculously avoided. The money that came at just the right time. How just the right person came into their life. God working in mysterious ways. That sort of thing. Do you not think so? I don't know what I think, she says heavily. It's all so new. How does someone even get started with all this? Manifestation is the visible part of the integration iceberg, the gross level of integration that even the most eyes-tight-shut person can sometimes detect. When people begin, if they begin, they begin by manifesting small, simple things. Good parking spaces and luck with green lights, for example. It works, and they think it's pretty nifty. But most people never go much further with it. They hit a roadblock when their bank accounts don't grow or their waistlines don't shrink, and they dismiss the whole thing as, literally, wishful thinking. They don't engage the process or allow it to engage them. The tipping point comes, if it comes, with the realization that little successes like parking spots and traffic lights aren't the exception. They're the rule. And when they don't come as requested, it just means you didn't understand the rule. But you can. She sighs and makes notes. Some people go further with it, I say. They read some books, learn to see the process, understand it, own it. They merge into the process and, to some degree, learn to put these forces to work in their lives. That's nice, but they're still cheating themselves, like working in the mailroom of a company and swiping office supplies, never realizing that they own the company. Something like that. I'm not sure I understand this at all, she moans as she writes. Understanding it conceptually doesn't matter much. I look at the cool blue water of the pool in front of us. You learn to swim by jumping into the water and swimming, not by sitting in a classroom studying aquadynamic theory. Practical application is what matters, and you're already in the pool, so to speak. The rest takes care of itself through natural processes of experimentation and observation and play, just like you developed your balance as a toddler. You weren't born with a finely tuned balance mechanism. It developed over time as you got up and started using it. A pain shoots up from my left knee, and I make an unmanly chirp. "Are you okay?" she asks, getting up. "Can I get you anything?" "I'm fine. Thanks," I say, and for the most part it's true. My body is happy. All the hurt areas feel pretty happy, and the unhurt areas all seem happy too. Nice pills. They're not making me groggy, and my brain seems to work. I've sometimes thought that, after the books are done, it might be interesting to get addicted to something and see what that's like. But I probably won't. I have a lot of dumb ideas about things to do after the books. Probably I'll just find some way to keep writing. Lisa sets fresh drinks on the table between us. She settles back into her lounger. "Where were we?" she asks. "You're the one with the notes." "Okay," she says, consulting them. "How would all this apply to someone in my situation? Where would someone like me actually begin?" "Your thoughts and emotions determine your dream state reality. That's where you start. From there, it's just a matter of simplifying the equation and eventually seeing that your thoughts and emotions are your dream state. It's all just consciousness. You are just consciousness. There is nothing else. Once that goes from thought-level concept to full immersion awareness, you naturally merge with the currents instead of being tossed about by them." She groans as she writes. I can see this is very challenging material for her. It's not so long ago that she would have scorned such talk. "Okay," she says. "I'd agree that probably everyone has some experience like what you're describing, or some religious or mystical explanation for things like that. I always just thought of it as serendipity, I guess."
"So you never prayed for anything?"
"Prayed? Well, yes, I've prayed. I've prayed for my babies to be healthy and whole. I prayed to pass the bar. Probably a few other things. And I guess those prayers were answered."
"Is that your point?"
"Not really. From your perspective, your prayers were answered, or at least events transpired as you prayed they would. I assume you don't really believe your children were healthy and you passed the bar because you prayed, do you?"
She shrugs.
"Couldn't hurt," she says with a smile.
"Exactly," I say. "That's probably how most people see it. They pray only when it's important. They make deals. No atheists in foxholes, as they say. But then, when the crisis is over, so is their urgent pleading with the unseen whatever to which they had addressed themselves."
"The unseen whatever?"
"God, higher self, angels, Jesus, Allah, Buddha, totems, ancestors, whatever. I might also say that even if your babies hadn't been healthy and you hadn't passed the bar, your prayers would still have been answered."
She seems displeased by that. "That doesn't make any sense," she says tersely.
"Not from the segregated perspective, but from the integrated perspective, it's just obvious. There's no alternative. We think miracles happen and prayers are answered only when it's something good, when it's in line with our hopes and desires, which, in human children, are always fear-based. We don't acknowledge the same forces equally at work when the results are not in line with our hopes and desires. We're very selective in our perceptions. Good luck, bad luck, it's all the same. The ebb and flow of tides, it just gets interpreted differently. She writes, but doesn't comment. I try a different approach. An ego-clad, fear-based being might use prayer or divination or manifestation to get the things they want. Health, love, career, money, family, vanity, the usual suspects. Once freed from egoic constraints, however, all such fear-driven wanting disappears and desire becomes very organic and non-specific. My prayer, if I were to utter one, might be for whatever's best, or that I should proceed without error. Something like that. She writes, I look at my toes and wiggle them. I get a little skeezed out if I think about toes for too long, so I'm glad when she interrupts with another question. You didn't pray to get your grandfather's house? She asks. Or the first one you tried to buy? No. I expressed intent through desire and action, but I never prayed in the sense you mean, like wanting something and asking for it. Even that is symptomatic of the distrustful, segregated mindset. The integrated state is seamless. It's without all these artificial boundaries and distinctions, such as one entity asking for something and another granting it. I want what's best, and I trust the universe, not my little brain, to be the judge of what's best and how best to make it happen. If I had locked my sights on that first house, decided I wanted it, and became insistent, I would have derailed the process. But I was open and observant and sensitive and came away with a much better result than I could have imagined or orchestrated. You might not be so calm and cool about it if it was your child you were worried about instead of a house. If I was claiming to be very strong in my beliefs, you'd be correct. But this isn't how I believe things work. It's how I see they work. When your eyes are open, you see everything, and belief becomes irrelevant and forgotten. You have trouble with that because you don't know your eyes are closed. You think they're open, and you naturally assume that you and I are in the same condition. Believe me, she says, I know we're not. You believe we're not in the same condition, but you don't see it. You're very close, though. You'll see soon enough. My point is that what people see in these occasional glimpses, by all these various names and explanations, is this ocean of being working in tireless, errorless perfection. That's what the dream state is. That's what we are. That's what consciousness is. You are nothing but consciousness. Everything that tells you more than that is like a built-up crust of hard-packed emotional energy that is formed around you like a shell. All true growth and development is first and foremost a process of chopping away this crust. Ego sends us searching in the direction of learning, of becoming more and adding on to ourselves. But everything we claim to seek lies in the opposite direction of unlearning, of letting go, of reducing. We think the goal is to become someone, but the universe can only be ours when we become no one. She groans again. Chapter 15. Manifest Destiny. I ask you only to stop imagining that you were born, have parents, are a body, will die, and so on. Just try. Make a beginning. It is not as hard as you think. Nisargadatta, Maharaj.
The setting sun turns the lake a fiery orange and streaks the mountains with vertical side-cast shadows. Lisa sets out a few simple food items, but the meds make everything taste hinky, so I don't eat. We relax and let the conversation wander pleasantly off track for a while. Eventually, she veers us back into it. "You're saying you can have anything you want?" she asks as she reads through her recent notes. "Is that right? Like everything is governed by some kind of magical energy, and if you can tap into it..." "Yes and no," I interrupt. "It's not so much that someone well established in the integrated state can have what they want, but that their wants and needs are in natural harmony with their dream state circumstances. In other words, it's not that I can have anything I want, like I wiggle my nose and it appears. It's also that I wouldn't want anything I couldn't have. I can't manifest a pile of money or a speedboat or a bowl of fish head soup because I have no authentic desire for those things. The difference between authentic and inauthentic desire is central to all this. But most people are completely cut off from their authentic desires." "Cut off by what?" "Ego is always the bad guy. Compare your own desires from a few years ago to your desires now. What kind of things did you want? To be a partner in a law firm? To drive a Lexus? To have more money? A bigger house? A tighter butt?" "That sounds familiar," she says sheepishly. "And where are those desires now?"
"I don't know. Just gone, I guess."
"Naturally. Just gone. That's the eliminative process at work. You didn't have to struggle with each and every bit of egoic material. You just struggled to take a difficult step, and, in moving forward, you left a huge mass of coagulated debris behind. Now you're starting to discover your authentic desires, and they don't have anything to do with getting more stuff or increasing your status or improving your image. Your authentic desires won't have anything to do with projecting an imagined self into the world, with grooming the reflection you cast in the eyes of others. All forms of adornment and ostentation will lose their appeal and even become distasteful, and a roofless old Ford Pinto will start looking much more comfortable than a shiny new Lexus." There's another pleasant lull before she looks to see if I have more. I return to her question about getting everything I want. Something like manifestation of authentic desires is a little hard to explain because the integrated state is outside the conceptual framework of the segregated state. Am I bending to fit the universe, or is it bending to fit me? The question doesn't survive translation. The distinction between me and not me has no meaning. The constraints of time and space and causality and duality have no counterparts in the integrated state. My knee sends up a sharp message. "Speaking of getting what I want, can you hand me my pills?" She gets the bottle out of my bag and reads the label. "Oh, Lord," she says, seeing what the meds are. "This is strong stuff. People get addicted to this. Are you not telling me something?"
"Did I tell you the part about handing them to me?"
She reads the warnings on the label. She starts passing them over to me, then pulls back. "So you want these pills?" she asks. Was I speaking in tongues? She mulls it over. "Is your desire authentic?" she asks with a sly grin. "Very," I assure her. So why don't you manifest them?
I did, I reply. I manifested a busted-up Ford Pinto so I could manifest my busted-up ass over to the pharmacy, where I manifested a method of payment. Then they manifested a bottle of pills, which you just manifested from the bag. Whole lot of manifesting going on.
She scowls. That doesn't sound very mystical.
I didn't say it was. Maybe you have some screwy notions.
She mulls some more, still holding my pills. But you can't manifest the pills these last few feet.
Can't I?
She shakes the bottle at me. I can withhold them, she says.
Can you?
This is a playful exchange. She's exploring ideas, and I'm trying to help her see what's there to be seen.
But, she says, if I don't give them to you, what then?
What then what? I like this therapeutic technique of turning every question back on the questioner. I should have thought of it years ago, a lazy man's Socratic method. Well, then you're in pain, and you're not getting what you want.
Yes.
But that contradicts what you're saying.
Does it?
Doesn't it?
Not really. There's no rule that says I can't be in pain, or that I have to get whatever I want, or that I can't sit here and explore these ideas this way. Something so bizarrely unlikely as those pills not making it these last few feet wouldn't happen without a clear reason, though, and certainly not just whimsically or randomly. Anyway, we're not in a situation like that. You're not going to do what you're saying.
But I could, she says.
Could you?
She mulls some more and hands the bottle to me. Like I said, I say, pausing to swallow some pills, it's not voodoo or mysticism or special powers. Those are segregated ways of explaining phenomenon that are perfectly normal and natural from the integrated perspective.
Oh, boy, she moans. What have I gotten myself into?
I shrug. Your life, I say. Speaking with Lisa is an interesting experience at this stage. I can see her vacillating between intellect and heart, between how she thinks she should be and how she wants to be and perhaps wants not to be. She's used to projecting a whole troop of complex characters, woman, mother, wife, boss, attorney, friend, etc., all strong and confident and well-grounded. And she's not used to this new role where she's weak and ignorant and helpless as an infant. No one is used to it. And the more rigidly fixed we were in our previous life, the more difficult our transition to our new life will be. This conversation we're having right now isn't really intended to teach her anything. I don't expect her to break her addiction to thought and logic overnight. I'm just trying to help her stretch out and soften up, give her a chance to adjust to her new environment, maybe show her some pretty new ideas she can play with. Like any newborn, she has muscles she's never used, ranges of motion she has yet to explore, and senses that she will need to develop. Not surprisingly, the most amazing discovery of someone newly liberated from a lifetime of suffocating bondage is the absence of suffocating bondage. She has recently emerged from a 3-year journey through the birth canal, completing her death-rebirth transition from womb to world, and the freedom she's just beginning to discover can be a very scary thing. Are you familiar with the 80-20 rule? I ask her. 20% of the effort accomplishes 80% of the work? And vice versa. Well, that's the deal here, too. 80% of this transition you're in can be accomplished with a relatively small amount of effort. All you have to do is get past the idea that you're a human being on planet Earth. Flush that belief out of your system, and a huge, massive, backed-up mental and emotional sewage automatically gets flushed out with it.
Oh, she laughs. Just like that, huh? Just get over my peculiar little notion that I'm a human being on planet Earth?
Well, I didn't say it was nothing. It takes some honest effort, and it takes some time to process the ramifications. Why? Does that seem like a big thing?
Are you kidding? She asks.
It is a big thing?
She gives me a funny look.
I can't tell if you're kidding, she says.
Okay, I say. I guess it sounds like a big thing, but it's really just one simple tweak in your thinking. Once you make this adjustment, you'll be far ahead of most of the respected experts in the field of human development and spirituality, totally off their maps, and you'll have taken an enormous step forward in your own process.
I'm still getting the funny look.
Once I realize that I'm not a human being on planet Earth, she asks. I take it you think you are.
Yeah, kinda.
Well, yes, of course you do, I say. I'm just suggesting you take another look at it. Think about it. No offense, but most people don't really think. They think they think, but they'll really go to any lengths to avoid it. And if they can't avoid it, they quickly discover that it's not something they've done before.
The funny look is looking less funny.
Now you're telling me I don't know how to think, but that I shouldn't be offended?
Yeah. Is that weird, too?
She pauses to select her words.
Are you completely out of touch? She asks.
Define completely. She takes a deep breath and lets it out.
You know, Jed, she says, until recently, a scowl from the girl at the coffee shop could throw off my whole morning. I'd put on makeup and brush my hair to go out to the mailbox. I'm trying to think in terms of small steps here.
So revisiting the assumption that you're a human being living on planet Earth would be, like, a really big step?
She takes another pause.
Can I ask you something?
Sure.
How long has it been since you were, you know, normal?
You mean, like a regular person? I ask.
Yes.
I don't know, I say. 20-some-odd years, I guess.
If ever.
Jed, I wouldn't presume to...
Presume away.
Well, you say that you're sort of fading out of existence, right? Getting more and more out of touch?
Something like that.
Is it possible that your memory of what it's like to be a normal person is no longer very clear?
Thou presumest rightly, I agree. But I'm still not sure this is as big a deal as you're making out. Let's use the movie The Matrix to map this out. My outside the Matrix character is telling your inside the Matrix character what the deal is. That you're living a fictional life as a fictional being in a fictional universe. I'm not saying you should break out of the Matrix, just that you can have an unimaginably better experience of your existence within it if you understand the wholly fictitious nature of it. Most people, of course, have no idea or have only a conceptual grasp.
But the Matrix is just a movie, she says.
And this is just the dream state, I reply. The movie The Matrix is solipsism, the cogito, Plato's cave, brain in the vat theory, and a great popcorn flick all rolled into one.
It's the death knell of philosophy and science and religion. Nothing is what you think it is, nor is it not. That's the dream state.
This sounds familiar, she says. Are there any spiritual or religious groups who believe they're not human beings on Earth?
Sure, I say. They're called cults, and we tend to ignore them until they start racking up a body count. I'm not encouraging you to believe that you're not a human on Earth, only to question your belief that you are.
The difference is
belief. It's all about belief. All beliefs serve as self-limitations, and they're all false.
But if I'm not a human being on planet Earth, what am I?
You're asking me?
Yes.
Well, to me, you're a minor character in my dramatic dreamscape, a semi-coherent, energetic pattern making a brief appearance on the stage of my awareness, a bit player whose timely appearance meshes precisely with current themes.
Aw, she grins. I bet you say that to all the girls.
I laugh. She chews on her bottom lip as she stares at me.
This isn't the pills talking.
I don't know. Sounds like me.
Yeah.
We sit quietly for a few minutes. I can feel her agitation.
You should watch The Matrix again, I suggest. Lots of useful stuff there. Remember when Neo was unplugged from The Matrix? He asks why his eyes hurt, and Morpheus answers.
Lisa provides the line.
Because you've never used them before.
Yes, I say. Welcome to the desert of the real.
She laughs uncomfortably.
In the movie, I continue, Neo is rejecting one layer of delusion in exchange for another, just as the inhabitants of Plato's cave are trading the illusion of the shadows on the wall for the broader illusion of the cave itself. In The Matrix, when someone is freed, they move into the broader cave-like reality of underground ships and caverns and Zion, and, as the movie portrays, it can seem like a very bad bargain. Someone might wish to re-enter a state of comfortable delusion rather than undergo the rigors and hardships of cave life. They might want to crawl back into the womb.
You can't do that, she says quietly.
No, I don't think so, I say.
Are you okay?
Yes. Please continue. This is interesting.
You sure?
I'm starting to understand some things better, she says. I'm starting to kind of see myself in this metaphor.
Good. Otherwise, it's just a movie.
That's what I thought it was, she says.
It's a tool, I say, a map on which we can plot our journey, or one leg of it. If the Neo character were really trying to awaken from the dream state, he wouldn't have accepted the subterranean world of Morpheus and Zion and freedom fighter drama so easily. He'd have recognized it as merely another layer of delusion and kept going.
Further, she says.
Exactly. Always further. Layers on top of layers, turtles on top of turtles. Neo never found out how deep the rabbit hole goes. He just went down one level, and having escaped from the Matrix, he is now more firmly in the grasp of delusion than ever. He knows the Matrix is an artificial reality, but he thinks he's out of it, so he's much more effectively imprisoned than before. He misinterprets his new state as freedom, but it is only a more convincing illusion of freedom.
And how does this apply to me?
This is your situation.
She checks her notes.
Now I'm more firmly in the grip of delusion than ever?
Meaning?
Meaning you've spent your discontent. You fired your rockets, and here you are.
She frowns.
This isn't negative, I say. This is good. You may not be happy and well-adjusted yet, but you're definitely in the right place. You got out of the place where you didn't want to be, where you'd rather die than stay. And now you're awakening within the dream state. But not from it? No. Your discontent wasn't of that nature. You're like Neo. And you're like Morpheus? I laugh. Only in the tour guide sense, I say. I'm showing you around a bit, explaining where you are and how things work. You have some groovy new abilities you can play with and learn about and get good at. I still can't imagine not believing I'm a human being on no one can ever imagine the next step until they've taken it. Every barrier seems impassable until the time comes when all other choices have dissolved and it's forward or perish. Could you have imagined a year ago what you've accomplished now? She laughs at the idea. No, she says. You take one step, which is always an act of destruction. Then you pause, rest, recuperate, reflect, maybe even think you're done. And then the next step starts to appear, and the option of not taking it starts to disappear. You've been through this once, so I assume you recognize what I'm saying. She nods slightly, head bowed to her notes. So now I'm describing the next step, and it's a doozy, almost of the same transformational magnitude as the one you've taken, but much less difficult. It's only natural that it looks impossible to you, but gradually the impossibility will be in not taking this step. She seems discouraged. No one traipses merrily along through this journey, Lisa. There is no bravery here, and no one takes a step out of desire. You go forward when you can't stay where you are. That's the process. That's how you got this far. And that's how you'll keep going, if you do. She writes, head down, quiet.